Hello and welcome to another episode of the Communication Research Podcast. This is Jim Shanahan. I'm a professor here at the Communication Research Center at Boston University. For more information about the podcast and the Communication Research Center, stay tuned at the end of the podcast and we'll give you information about our website and other links. On today's podcast, we're welcoming as our guest Michael Dahlstrom. Michael's an assistant professor at the Greenlee School of Journalism and Communication at Ohio State University. Welcome and thanks for coming, Michael.
Yes, happy to be here. Actually, it's at the Iowa State University.
What did I say?
I said Ohio.
Oh, sorry.
No problem.
Start again. Iowa State.
Okay.
I have a lot of friends at Ohio State. Iowa State, yes. We want attribution correct. Greenlee School of Journalism and Communication at Iowa State.
Perfect.
Perfect. Sorry about that. And so the primary reason we asked Michael on the podcast today is to talk about an article that has recently appeared in the journal Environmental Communication. The title of the article is Diversity of Television Exposure and Its Association with the Cultivation of Concern for Environmental Risks. So, Michael, we'll talk a bit about cultivation in general and, of course, the specifics of your study as well. For listeners to the podcast not versed with cultivation, could you give a short summary of what the theory proposes and what the findings have generally been in the area of cultivation?
Sure. So the basic idea of cultivation is that the worldview of television, the world that television portrays, does not always match with reality. But the idea is the more that people are exposed to television, more that they're exposed to this worldview, the more that they will start to accept this worldview as reality.
Exactly. And so this research is amongst the various theories we have in media effects and mass communication research, one of the older ones dating back to the late 60s, founded originally by George Gerbner and his colleagues at Annenberg School at Penn. And literally hundreds of studies have been conducted in this area. Now, as you point out in your article, and by the way, this piece is co-authored with Dietram Scheufele from Wisconsin at Madison. As you point out in this piece, there are relative I guess one thing we should note is that, you know, cultivation has been looked at with a variety of topics, violence, perceptions of sex roles, things like that. The topic of environmental concern or environmental issues has been examined relatively less frequently. And so your study coming as it does is one of maybe, I think we could, I guess, count them on two hands, the number of studies that have looked specifically at television's cultivation of environmental concern. And listeners may think, well, there must be a lot of studies on the media and the environment, and that's true, especially for news, but much less so in cultivation. What drew you to examining this issue, environmental risk and perception of it specifically?
Well, a couple reasons. One reason is, first of all, that's my interest.
Mm-hmm.
My PhD is joint with communication and environmental resources, but I think primarily the environment as a topic is very susceptible to media portrayals because many environmental risks are fairly unobtrusive. You know, you can't really see global warming happening. You might hear about pollution, but it's far away. So a lot of what people base their environmental perceptions on is what they read about in the media. So I thought that it's potentially a very large effect and important, and the fact that there hasn't been too much about it, I thought there was a hole that needed to be filled.
Well, right. I agree with that. It's something that I thought early on when doing studies in this area, and this goes back 20 years, when there had been, in about 87, 88, there was sort of a wave of media attention to the environment in the news. This was the era in which, you know, Time magazine was saying that instead of the man of the year, they had the Earth as the planet of the year. You know, there was sort of a and Hollywood people were, you know, getting involved, and they were saying, hey, you know, the media are really going to help the environment. And But there hadn't been much examination of the impact, the kind of impacts that cultivation especially would locate from non-news programming, mostly fictional entertainment. And so most cultivation studies do try to encompass the television system as a whole. Do you feel similarly that it's especially important to take a look at programming other than news in terms of people's environmental conceptions?
Oh, I think absolutely. I think news gets the majority of attention because that's where we have kind of our cognitive learning and perceptions. But entertainment, I mean, if you think about how you spend most of your day, what media you consume, obviously there's going to be news there in different degrees for different people. But I think entertainment actually may fill a much larger space of people's day. And so ignoring the effect of entertainment on environmental perceptions, I think, is losing a big amount of variance.
Yeah, and that was the original argument of the original cultivation theorists, was that the large majority of time spent viewing is going to be with primetime programming, mostly, certainly in the early years, fictional drama, comedy, and so forth. The landscape has changed, but still, obviously, we're exposed to a wide variety of programming that's non-fictional or narrative storytelling in some way, shape, or form. So most cultivation studies have used essentially as the independent variable a measure of overall television viewing, and almost all of them. Some, as you know, some authors have argued that that's a problem. But one of the main novelties or additions to the literature that you're proposing here is a measurement of diversity of television exposure. So can you explain what you mean by diversity of television exposure, especially in relationship to the traditional measure that we've used, which is really just sort of how much television do you watch on an average day?
Yeah, the idea of the diversity of exposure is this idea that in the media, in the television worldview, it might not be completely consonant. There might be different viewpoints scattered across the media landscape. So the more diverse your viewership, or you could say how many different channels or shows or a variety of things that you see, you would be exposed to different worldviews than someone who watches probably the same amount of television, but just one channel or just a small, narrow band of channels.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, the idea came from the co-author, Dietram. I was a student in his public opinion class.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were talking about all these different theories and models of public opinion. And one that we got to was heterogeneity of networks and how that impacts political communication. And I thought that was very interesting. And then a couple units later, we moved on to cultivation. And what struck me as strange was that there was so much emphasis on diversity in this area of political communication, but there was really nothing or very little in cultivation. So,
well, probably nothing.
Probably nothing. Okay.
Yeah. There must be something, but you're right, very little.
And so the idea was to see if we could take that same idea that had large effects over in another area, bring it to cultivation and see if the importance followed.
Yeah, and it struck me as, you know, kind of, why didn't I think about that kind of thing? Because there are plenty of, so listeners know, I do research in cultivation, have done for a long time. There have been plenty of critics or others who have said, well, we really should look at exposure to particular genres. So if we want to know about crime, we'll look at crime shows. If we want to know about sex roles, we might look at soap operas, this type of thing. And there's plenty of discussion of that. There really isn't, to my knowledge, though, this particular spin on it, which is a little bit different, in the sense of saying, well, it's taking the sort of heterogeneity of exposure idea from, as you say, political communication research. And I know Dietram's incorporated that variable into multiple studies with interesting effects in the political communication arena, because the consonance that I see, at least as I think about it now, especially with Gerbner's original thinking, was that when you're exposed to television, his argument was that you're exposed to a system of messages. So he saw it as an organized whole with a specific function and purpose and so forth. This diversity of exposure actually operationalizes that to some extent. At least I'm thinking that's kind of what you're arguing. Do you see the point I'm driving at there?
Oh, yes, yes.
So that it's instead of just assuming everyone is uniformly exposed to the message, you're essentially measuring the extent to which they're exposed to a system versus something special.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So that's I think the first thing to point out. Now I have a question. In some of the early studies, and we're going back to the 90s. We had findings that were along the lines of heavier television viewers are less concerned about the environment. And here, the issue I'm driving at is how we think of concern. In some of those studies, concern was framed as really a multidimensional construct that might have included things like, I'm willing to give money to environmental causes, I recycle, so on and so forth, and also things like I am concerned about, say, global warming, or back in the 90s, you know, the acid rain, or what have you. And in your study, your measure of perception of environmental risk, you had four questions available to you from your data set. And I guess we should mention what data set were you using for this again?
Yeah, this is the annual lifestyle study by Cinevate for DDB Chicago.
Right. Can you remind me then the original four questions?
Yes.
Yeah.
The first one was, I would be willing to accept a lower standard of living to conserve energy. Second one is, I make a strong effort to recycle everything I possibly can. The third one is, I worry a lot about the effects of environmental pollution on my family's health. And the fourth one is, I'm very concerned about global warming.
Right. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe you chose the latter two.
Correct.
As your measure, because you found that they're sort of tapping two different things, right?
Exactly. The last two, I mean, very clearly, I'm very concerned about global warming and I worry a lot. I mean, it's a very affective, I worry about the risks of the environment. The first two seem to be more of, what will you be willing to do based on your perceptions?
Right. And what your discussion crystallized for me was interesting, because over the course of the 20 years in which these, you know, 10 studies have, you know, the few studies that we know about have appeared, there is, I wouldn't call it confusion, but there is still an open question as to what we really mean with our dependent variable. So in some of the early studies, the finding that heavy television viewers are less concerned, and then you have some other studies where heavy television viewers are more fearful, let's say, depending on how we frame it, it might appear to be a paradox. But what's your reaction if I say something like, is it possible that we can have simultaneously more fear using the kind of measures that you did, and less concern in the sense of actions that people would be willing to take? Do you see what I'm...
Yeah. And I think it falls right onto how slippery of a concept the environment is, because it's so large. What are you talking about? So you can worry a lot about the risks of the environment if you look at risk communication. And then that can be completely separate about what you intend to do. It could be that the worry is so high that you feel there's nothing you can do. There's no self-efficacy. So
right.
I fear, but I won't act.
Right. And, yeah, that's something I've thought about. So I think, and this was the first thing that popped into my head looking at your dependent variable, because, you know, your hypothesis That heavier that exposure will be positively related to risk perception could be interpreted as being at variance with some earlier studies showing heavier viewers less concern. And I think it's really a matter of what concern means. And I had given what you just said at least some passing thought, the idea, I think this would be a future study, that you can have simultaneously more fear and that a result of the fear might be precisely sort of a feeling of paralysis or a feeling of, as you say, there's no efficacy there to confront something as global or even as hugely regional as, you know, the BP oil crisis, you know, not quite sure what could, you know, I'm deathly afraid of that, but what can I do, you know? But that's not dealt with in your study, but I felt it was interesting to bring it up because the few studies that we do have are already exploring different conceptualizations of the dependent variable, whether it's best to call it risk perception. Earlier, more general terms were used like concern and those terms I think need to be specified better. And I guess I can make those criticisms because I was the one who was calling it concern. So we need to work on that. Well, let's move ahead. What do we know then about what television tells us about the environment?
Well, that's interesting because to do a cultivation study, you need to know what is on TV. You need to know what the worldview is that's out there. And this study was based on a content analysis of environment on television from actually your work, which I believe was the late 90s.
Right.
So it looked at the content of television and environment on television in the late 90s. And so based on that, you can then make some predictions, heavy viewers, light viewers, exposure diversity, etc.
Yes. I feel stupid asking you what I said, but I'm the interviewer, I guess. What surprises me, Michael, is that there really hasn't been much work on entertainment television since then. So it's something we're thinking that we need to redo because the landscape has changed since the late 90s. Obviously, you know, new networks are available. The impact of the internet has changed television and so forth. But the findings were essentially what?
Well, yeah, at the time, and I agree, I think it would be fascinating to update this. At the time, there was very little environmental coverage. I think, if I remember right, it was 1.7% of the coverage had the environment as a major theme.
Yeah.
So basically, it was not there.
Right.
When it was there, it was pretty consistent to focus on risk and concern. So when the environment was mentioned, there's problems, there's risks,
right?
Which led to the predictions.
Yeah.
What I think would be very interesting is it's much different today. I mean, even I'm working on another analysis of global warming, and you can see the graph of frequency of coverage. And across the 90s and the early 2000s, there's a little increase, but not much. There's not much coverage. But about 2006, 2007, it explodes.
Boom, yeah.
I think there were many months in those years where there was over 150 and 200 articles per month.
Well, you know, interestingly, we did work in that area. When I say we, primarily my co-author at that time was Catherine McComas at Cornell, and we were looking at cycles of news coverage of climate change, and we were saying, hey, look, here's a huge cycle from 1988 to 1992, and then it kind of goes away, and then it comes back in 97 around the time of Kyoto. But if we compare all those cycles to, as you say, what happened after, let's say, 06, they look, suddenly the entire scale of the graph has changed. And they're sort of little blips on the radar. So
that's right. It's like looking for mountains in the Midwest, and then you see the Rockies.
Exactly. So we thought we were. I think at that time they were mountains, and maybe there's a scalability of attention. Who knows?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, just so much coverage, and so I'm glad to hear that's being looked at by you. So we'll look forward to that. But yeah, I guess in general, there's some. It may be a bit tough to pin down exactly, but there's been certainly a qualitative shift somewhere in the 2000s in terms of media attention to the environment. Whether it's good, bad, or neutral, I'm not sure. What's your take on that?
Well, again, this is going to be anecdotal because
sure.
we haven't looked at it
right.
empirically yet. But my guess is, before the mid-2000s, there was quite a bit of, you know, here's global warming, here's some evidence for it. But I think now it's moved into more of a conflict phase where most of the stories are pitting one side against the other or are accusing one side of spin or one side of bias. And I think it's moved much more into the human drama phase as opposed to the scientific fact-driven phase.
Yeah. I mean, there are some models suggest that, you know, a typical issue will go through kind of a, you know, there will be a conflict phase, but it will be followed by sort of it moves into the policy arena, gets solved and goes away. Well, clearly that hasn't happened with climate change or global warming, whatever we want to call it. And obviously the so-called climate gate scandal must have contributed enormously to your peaks. And I think one thing I've learned is once we finish this study, we should just start the next one because it's obviously an evolving issue. But in any case, the content that you were looking at is matched up with the data set that you're looking at temporally in some way, right?
Correct.
Yeah. So this is a way to test, I guess I would say it looks to me as much a way to test a new idea for cultivation theory and environment as more so than a commentary on current environmental coverage.
Correct.
And
in fact, I would guess if you pretty much looked at the same predictions using current data, you would find much, much different effects.
Right. And that in itself would be a great test of cultivation, too, because
exactly.
Yeah, because over the years, cultivation research, a potential weakness is that in many areas, it sort of tested the same hypothesis over and over again with slight variations. But we're seeing this in other areas, too, where there is social change. If you can find that television messages have changed and the cultivation patterns do change consistently, you're actually confirming the theory. So an example would be sex roles, which we all know attitudes about sex roles have changed dramatically since the 60s and the 70s, and also on television. And some of my co-authors and I have been looking at that sort of tentatively and seeing that, in fact, these kinds of things do change. So maybe you're exactly right that the same type of thing might be happening with environmental issues. Well, let's turn specifically to the study. What, given that you've got a measure of risk perception,
mm-hmm.
you also have a measure of overall exposure and a measure of exposure diversity. In other words, how many different types of shows do people usually watch? What hypotheses did you work on with those?
Well, the first one was basically the classic cultivation hypothesis, which was people who are exposed to a larger amount of television should behave in the way that was predicted, which was for our time period, greater television would be associated with greater concern. The second hypothesis brought this exposure diversity into the idea, and it was that people exposed to a wider range of television content would also be associated with greater concern for environmental risks based on the time period. And when we looked at the results, first we accounted for demographics. So
right.
Sex, race, age, education, ideology, religiosity, and income.
Yep.
So controlled for that. And even just looking at the demographics, we find that women and more liberally minded respondents perceived greater concern for environmental risks, which is somewhat expected.
Right.
So then after regressing that, we put in the TV exposure, and there was an effect. So the hypothesis was confirmed that the more TV that someone watches, the more concern there was. Next, we put in the diversity, and this is where it got interesting. It turned out that, yes, the more diverse channels, the more diverse exposure, there's more risk. But as soon as you account for the exposure diversity, the TV amount drops away. So the diversity itself accounted for enough of the amount variance that actually it overpowered the amount.
Certainly consistent with another sort of, or another kind of typical pattern in cultivation is at least sometimes one will examine the, what you call the sort of the classic traditional hypothesis, just exposure and some perception, and you find that. And then later when, this often happens when you look at interactions of television with, for instance, some of the demographics you had, the interactions turn out to be more powerful than the basic cultivation relationship and can lead to things such as mainstreaming, which is a classic finding. And so this this sort of specification, I guess I would call it, has been going on in cultivation for a long time, although in this case you're not interacting TV with something else. You're creating sort of you're proposing and using a new measure of television exposure. One thing about the actual exposure measure and the diversity, and correct me again, this measure did not include exposure to networks?
Correct. The diversity measure, we were limited by what was in the data set, and it was just popular cable television channels.
Right.
So I believe there were 28 channels that the respondent could say they watch frequently because they, I think it was because they really like it.
Yeah. Yes. But the exposure measure was simply, you know, how much do you watch on an average day type of question, right?
That's correct. It was it broke the day into units, and it said, was the TV on at this time, at this time, at
right.
this time?
Right. Listen,
so there will be some that's unaccounted for, assuming that during the amount variable, some people are watching network television. That's not captured in the diversity.
Right. And so you're limited by the secondary data set there. Listeners should also know that this is an ongoing issue in cultivation, how to measure exposure. So there's more than one way to skin that cat, obviously. And some are very simple questions. How much TV do you watch on an average day? Other studies that I've worked on, we've done similar things where you have day parts. So, you know, how much did you watch after work and before dinner? And, you know, there's different ways. They produce different estimates. And so that's something that should be acknowledged. So, but to sum this up, to put it in a nutshell, the overall exposure is associated with more risk perception. That's consistent with cultivation. When you add diversity into the mix, you find that more diverse exposure is also associated with more risk perception.
Correct.
And that controls out or washes out the effect of overall exposure.
That's correct.
Okay. Why then should more diverse exposure be associated with a more risk perception?
During the time period, it was found that there wasn't that much environmental coverage, but what was there was risky, was framed in a risk fashion. So the idea with this hypothesis was based on that time period. If I only watch a very few number of channels or a small width of the complete television diversity spectrum, chances are I'm not going to get anything about the environment. I probably won't see those risk events. But as my diversity increases, I have a greater chance of seeing the rare but consonant perceptions of the environment as something that's risky.
Right. And it would be interesting. So, you know, a metaphor might be the environment is really a needle in the haystack of television programming. You know, in those early content analyses, of course, there's always, the environment is always there. There's always trees. There's, you know, people are in environments, obviously, although actually the number of programs that were just remained inside was pretty high. So what we were looking at was really programs that had a very specific environmentally oriented theme. And as you say, that was a very low number. So really trying to translate your finding into one sentence is that the more diverse or the wider range of programs you are likely to watch, the more you are likely to essentially stumble across, perhaps even randomly, those rare but negative images. Is that a
correct?
Yeah. So that's a very interesting and unique approach to cultivation. As I said before, I don't think I've really seen the diversity of exposure expressed in that way, or certainly operationalized in that way. I think you had another notion or a third hypothesis, really, where you were speculating about both variables together. What can you tell us about the potential interaction that you expected?
Well, the interaction between amount and diversity, I thought could be quite powerful. So it would seem that the greater amount of television that someone watches could interact with a greater diversity to emphasize the effect. So even if someone has a wide diversity but hardly watches television, mm-hmm. they wouldn't see the effect.
Yeah.
However, we did not find
right
any evidence for that interactive effect.
So, open question. Another question I have is, what is the relationship between, at least in your data, between amount or between simple exposure and diversity? That is, you might think, oh, well, somebody who watches a lot must be more likely to watch a greater diversity. But that doesn't necessarily have to be the case. One can imagine one who watches relatively little television but spreads it across a lot of channels. Is there any relationship observed between those two variables in your data?
You know what? I don't know. I don't think I either looked at that or did not bring that into the final manuscript.
Well, interesting question, because tell me if I'm making sense here. If you might think the more you watch, that means you have a greater chance to have diverse viewing.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not sure that it necessarily turns out that way. We may, for instance, have the stereotype of the very picky viewer, you know, who watches only specific programs. You know, I only watch PBS or quality cable or something like that. So I think that's something, if this diversity of exposure concept is picked up, that'll be an interesting thing to explore, because it really goes very directly to some of the questions that were raised right from the start, which is, if you watch a lot, you know, the assumption has been you're kind of watching all the same stuff, you know. It's pretty much you're watching what's on the networks. You know, certainly back in the 60s, there were three networks, so you could say, well, there wasn't much choice, and all the shows were similar, so a heavy viewer was a heavy viewer was a heavy viewer. Now I'm not quite so sure whether that's true, and particularly with an operationalized way to look at diversity of exposure.
I agree. I think that would be a very interesting thing to look at.
Yeah. Now, and I don't want to overspeak. You know, things in my memory are a little, possibly a little foggy here, but there have been studies that asked viewers to sort of check off lists of genres of programs that they were interested in and so forth. So, but it's not been a major theme in the literature. So we'll see if that gets picked up. Are you planning any future research along these lines with that variable?
Well, actually, yes. I've if there was another recent content analysis that discussed the role of environment on television, I think would be very instructive to pretty much rerun the experiment with a new content analysis and see what comes out.
So a naturalistic field experiment across 20 or 30 years worth of program content and cultivation relationships.
That would be wonderful.
Okay, we'll put that on the to-do list and get back to you. Now, secondly, you've got a paper coming out in Comm Research, Communication Research, and it deals with narratives. It's not precisely on environmental communication, but I think there's some related issues that interest me. So I thought we'd talk about this. So,
sure.
The title of the paper is The Role of Causality in Information Acceptance in Narratives, an Example from Science Communication. And as I said, this is coming out in Comm Research, correct?
Correct.
So here you're focusing on something near and dear to my heart, which is being explicit about a focus on narrative. And the reason why this ties in with cultivation, I think, is that cultivation, the way I interpreted it, was never so much about television as it was about narratives.
Exactly.
And television, of course, happened to be and still maintains a major role as a storyteller in our culture. If it had been some other kind of box, then we might be studying that. So, to me, the narrative is at the center of everything here. But one of the things that this paper, which you were kind enough to send me the manuscript of, points out is that narrative, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but is somewhat understudied in media effects or persuasion. Am I overstating your position?
Yeah,
here?
I don't know if I'd say it's understudied, mm-hmm. but I think there has been a certain conceptualization of narrative that has followed this research, and I think there's an important source of variance that gets overlooked when that conceptualization is used.
So what are we overlooking?
So I think a lot of narrative studies, and they've been wonderful to let us know about how narratives can change the way that people perceive the world. Mm-hmm. But a lot of them treat the narrative itself as the unit of interest.
Right.
So a lot of them place a message or an assertion or something within a narrative, and then we'll test how that compares to the same assertion in a non-narrative. Or we will look at...
Well, can we just stop there so
sure.
that a non-narrative would be what, like a list of facts or something?
It could be, but it could also be maybe more of a statistical,
right.
Analytical treatment of the same idea, as opposed to something that has characters that draws you through.
Right. So I just want to make this clear for the listeners that the narrative idea means we're telling some type of story, and within it we want to embed a fact or something that we wish the audience to absorb and believe or what have you. And the idea is because people essentially like stories, understand them, know how to think in that way, will the embedding of that information in a story be more effective than presenting a list of facts or various other ways that don't involve character, plot, that type of thing?
Correct. And I think one area that people may be have experience in this is a lot of the medical dramas mm-hmm. on TV. There's been a few studies that look at if I put in this health information or this risk information about health into this drama, it could be House, it could be Grey's Anatomy, do people believe it? And will people act on that, even though it's not explicitly said that, yes, this is true?
Well, there was, wasn't there a study recently with, was it House or both shows?
I think both.
Yeah. I can't remember the facts they were embedding. Excuse me. So what does the research tell us about that type of strategy?
Well, it's somewhat contradictory. On one side, there's a lot of research that says, yes, narratives can have a pretty strong influence on what people believe, especially if they get transported into the narrative. So if you are really into the story, you're really paying attention and you're interested, then you follow what happens in the story and you're not as picky about generating counter-arguments or trying to reason whether or not some of the stuff is accurate. So it's pretty consistent that it does have an effect, but measuring that effect gets a little tricky because, well, one is because narrative itself is such a dense, complex construct. So there was a meta-analysis, I believe, last year
mm-hmm.
that looked at narratives in health communication.
Right.
And the recommendation was that we know so little about the effects of narrative communication on health practices that we should avoid using them in ethical situations until more is known.
Yeah, and one can imagine why in health communication we'd be so concerned, because if the idea is that we want to really communicate the actual risk of heart disease or what have you, and can't say for certain whether it's better to embed that in a narrative or what kind of narrative and so forth, then better simply not to do it at all until
we
have more data.
Mm-hmm.
Although, you know, my feeling, again, this is anecdotal on my part, obviously, is that, you know, the narrative is for a variety of reasons, it seems to me a natural way that we sort of accept, present, understand information. But as you said, it's a very dense and complicated concept, and narratives can be they can appear in many different guises and forms. So in this research here, how are you conceptualizing a narrative, and how are you treating it so that you can look at essentially the structure within it, which is
sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the purpose of this study was to kind of open up narrative and look at within narrative variants. So the idea was, I took the idea of causality or causal chain from discourse psychology,
yeah,
which states that within a narrative, there are certain areas where the information has a causal effect, so a cause-effect relationship, upon later events in the narrative. And those are called causal locations. This is opposed to areas that, you know, maybe add to the color of the narrative or add to the detail, but really have no effect later on. And those are called the non-causal locations. And in discourse psychology, causality has had a wide range of effects in how people comprehend narratives and how they learn and how they remember. But that idea had not been brought over into narrative persuasion. So the idea was to take one narrative, locate the slots that were causal and slots that were non-causal, and then rotate environmental assertions between those areas. So for instance, some people would see assertion 1, 2, and 3 in causal locations, and 4, 5, and 6 in non-causal. The next person would see them flipped.
Yeah. Michael, I'm not sure if we've clarified this adequately, but in terms of what a causal location is, my understanding is that a causal slot or location is a place in the story where everything else that follows that place depends on that. In other words, without that event or action in the story, nothing else would make sense. And I'm wondering if you could sort of give an example of that.
Sure. I'll pick a story that I know everyone is aware of. So we'll mm-hmm. just do the Three Little Bears.
Sure.
And so in the story, the bears are eating their porridge. It's too hot, so they leave to go for a walk, which lets Goldilocks in to finish more of the story. So a causal example would be when the bears get up and leave, because the fact that they leave the house allows Goldilocks to come in, and we get progression within the story. A non-causal location would be the porridge that the bears are eating. So the bears could be eating porridge or oatmeal or cornflakes, and it really has no bearing on the rest of the story. It's just a nice detail that adds to
yeah.
it. So we'd have the non-causal versus the causal.
So in longer stories, where if you have long periods of description, or, you know, the mountains were blue, and but it's not, you know, the plot is not advancing, so to speak, would it be correct to say that those are as well non-causal locations?
Yeah, yeah. Another example, we could go back to the house or Grey's Anatomy.
Sure.
Let's say the science that someone wanted to portray was too much unprotected sun can result in skin cancer.
Yep.
So let's say we have a patient that comes in who has skin cancer because of this. You have to look at what is the purpose of that event within the narrative. So if the fact that the patient has skin cancer then causes one of the doctors to realize something else about another patient, maybe about skin or some
right.
other type of cancer, that would be causal. Because of the skin cancer, we have this next event. If the purpose was just to show how busy the ER was that day, then it really doesn't matter if it's skin cancer or a gunshot wound or anything. So in that case, the same event would be non-causal because it really leads to nothing.
Yeah, I think as I'm thinking about House, for instance, there are cases where they show him, you know, he has to work in the clinic. It's sort of a comedic moment. And he has a moment with somebody who has, you know, some sort of inconsequential illness, and it's kind of a joke. It doesn't, it's really the B story. It doesn't advance the main story.
Exactly.
So perhaps there are even degrees of causality here. Yeah, it advances a subplot, perhaps, or a minor one. But I guess we get the issue here is that there are, if a narrative is essentially a linearly ordered sequence of events and actions carried out by characters, towards some conclusion, that the key points in the narrative are when things happen that advance that linear sequence.
Correct.
And recognizing that there are numerous definitions of narrative, that seems to be the way you're working with it here. Now, I know for the purposes of your study here, you used a much simpler story. And some simpler assertions. So, what type of story were you using here?
Yeah. So, to manipulate this, I had to create a narrative that had these slots. I could put an assertion in a causal location and in a non-causal location without disrupting the flow of the story. And so, that was actually quite difficult because I had to be able to say something in one area of the narrative and say it again in another area. And it still made sense.
Right.
So what we had was a list of environmental assertions, such as wild pansies rotate throughout the day to face the sun, or mushrooms are more likely to grow on the windward side of a log.
Right.
And then the way that we got that into the narrative is the story is about pirates, inexperienced pirates, who are trying to find buried treasure, and they have a book of hints to get them through. So basically, they have some adventure, and they come to some barrier, and the only way to progress is to look in this book, which handily has these environmental assertions.
Right.
And then because of that assertion, that leads to the next step.
Now, I think we have to stop right there and say that this may be the first pirate-based study of that I've ever encountered in the social science literature.
I'm quite proud of that.
Yeah, no, so, you know, that's really the whole reason for the interview here. But seriously, so it's how long is the story? I assume it's a relatively short task for the...
I think it was, I'm trying to remember, I think it was about 2,000 words.
Yeah, so a few pages.
Yeah.
All right, so... there's a few more hypotheses in your study. You begin by, what I wanted to pick up on here is this notion of why should we remember? Why should we find things placed at causal locations to be more persuasive than somewhere else in the story? In other words, what's the psychology that you're thinking lies behind that?
Yeah, I think. Coming from discourse psychology, where there's a tradition that these causal areas are much easier to recall, so they become integrated in memory much easier, the idea is that when you're reading the narrative or viewing the narrative, these causal structures are more easily integrated into memory, which lead to greater recall. So it could be that later on, when you are asked, you know, what is the truthfulness of the statement, the fact that it's already there, it's accessible in your mind, it's just easier to rate that higher. Now, we looked at whether or not recall was a mediating variable in this study.
Right.
And it became marginally significant, but it was not significant. But I will say in two other studies that are coming out, it actually was significant. So I do think the recall is at least a partial mechanism for why this causal structure does relate in greater belief.
So in the study we're talking about now, you're saying it was marginally significant, perhaps with a larger number of subjects might have reach significance and you finding it to be significant to others. The reason I'm bringing this out is because, and I'm going outside of my own area of expertise here, but I find it interesting, is that there's the metaphor I'm taking out of it is that a narrative can be sort of compared to, there's a kind of network model, I guess, of that narrative.
Mm-hmm.
And that the nodes, the key nodes, are places where things happen. And almost all the folks who, you know, outside, I'm talking outside of psychology now, but in literary criticism or what have you, who analyze plot or narrative and all structures and so forth, it's almost always focused around actions that, you know, move the whole enterprise forward. So is it too far-fetched to say that we remember events at causal locations, as you call them and others call them, because that's in fact how our mind is either equipped or structures our understanding of the narrative itself?
I think so, exactly. I think the way that people comprehend narratives is exactly in that route. And then an effect of that is this this different levels of belief change based on comprehension.
Right. So it's fascinating, you know, and it goes back, again, the connection back to cultivation is very interesting because one thing that even Gardner was saying early on is, you know, it's and this is why I was talking about narrative perhaps being understudied, and maybe that's an overstatement, I'm not sure, but, you know, this at that time the notion was this essentially studying media messages as messages, you know, and just the persuasiveness of them or the lack thereof resides somewhere in the message, almost as kind of an atomic unit, you know, as a molecule of information or something like that. And I think Gerbner was trying to move beyond that to say you really have to pay attention to not just the story itself, but even the system of stories or the master narrative, the meta narrative, you know. And it's tough to do because, as you point out, narratives are complex. You can have a simple one like you talk about in your study, and I believe you mentioned in your lit review others that have gone on to be much longer and also studied. Obviously, a program like House that we've been talking about, that's an hour-long narrative, so very complex. But we should get the findings out. So in terms of the hypothesis first one, causal assertions, excuse me, it's tough to say, causal assertions should be recalled more. What did you more than what you would find in a control group?
Yes, and this was basically a manipulation check to make sure that the way I operationalized causality mirrored what was in discourse psychology. And yes, so we did find that causal statements were recalled with much greater frequency than non-causal or control statements.
Right, and now my notes say that you're. You also were looking at the perceived truthfulness of them.
Yes. Yeah, so this one is what I think is the real contribution.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just recall, but after the fact, after the narrative, and after a distraction task, people thought that those assertions that were associated with the causal locations were much more likely to be truthful in the real world, outside of the narrative world. In the real world, they're probably true.
Right. Now, that is interesting. But so the mediation, the effort with mediation was to show this really is a function of recall. And I guess what you're suggesting is that your body of research is at least partially supporting that.
Yes.
But there may be other things going on as well.
Oh, exactly. I think the recall, which later studies are supporting, is probably just one aspect of this mechanism.
Could it be that the recall is sort of the first hurdle, and then, you know, if you can't recall it, obviously, you know, that presents issues for later drawing an inference that your beliefs were somehow affected by the message?
Yes, I think so.
I mean, there's certainly a variety of persuasion theories where, you know, recall and attention and memory and so forth are the sort of conceived as the first gate that you have to get through. And if this sort of approach to narrative suggests that there are sort of hotspots within the narrative where you'd want to place meaningful things, that, you know, the message essentially, then recall would be an important one. Have you thought much about what other mechanisms might be beyond that?
Oh, actually, yes. That's what some of the future research is looking at.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple of them, I'm still analyzing the data, but we are looking at change over time. And it looks like even though recall may be associated with this activation of this perceived truthfulness, it quickly dissociates. So after a two-week time period, recall has basically dropped off the map.
Yeah.
But the perceived truthfulness really has not changed.
Interesting. Now, can we tie that back to cultivation? Because, you know, if we have...
Absolutely. I really think that cultivation and narrative studies are siblings. Because cultivation is basically the cumulative effect of narratives over time, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And so what it would seem like is you have a narrative, the recall drops off, but you accept these into your worldview. You see this multiple times over a long time period, and narrative persuasion could be one of the mechanisms that drives the effects of cultivation.
Right. Well, I agree with you 100% on that, and I like your choice of the term siblings. But of course, this relationship, which I think is real, has also received less attention maybe than it should, because, as you know, there was so much controversy over cultivation, its method, mm-hmm. I think some misunderstanding of what it was trying to say back in the early days, and now some concern about what can it really say given the change in the television environment. But I think, you know, I am seeing, not just in your work, but an emergence of what I hope will be a more fruitful period of examining narratives. One thing that strikes me, and I know this must be evident to you, is lots of people are talking about framing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can't avoid that in the field of communication research or media effects. Probably one of the dominant concepts. But a frame can mean lots of different things. And sometimes some researchers, when they talk about frames, it seems to me they are talking about stories. But it can mean frames can mean lots of things. Have you thought at all about the relationship of narratives to frames?
Yes. This is a topic that I'm actually wrestling with right now.
Yep.
And I think there's actually a continuum.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can imagine a continuum, one side is more frame-like,
yep.
and the other side is more narrative-like.
Yep.
And depending on how you define both frames and narrative, they fall within that. So I think when you – well, let's go far to one side.
Mm-hmm.
I think when you have frames, which are basically schemas or just kind of open slots,
yep.
I think that would fall more to the frame side. There's really no temporal movement as in a narrative. There's no specific characters.
Right.
As you start to travel more towards the narrative, you start to get some of those traditional narrative elements working in. So you might have more specifics within your frame idea, but you might not have the temporal timeline. And I really think it's a definitional terminology issue.
Yeah. Well, there are articles out already complaining about the so-called fractured nature of framing research, and I think that's something that needs to be resolved. But I've always been of the belief that the heart of it lies in the narrative, and that a lot of the techniques, especially those of us who are, you know, more schooled in the older tradition, so, you know, didn't necessarily have methods or training to really build that understanding of narrative into our methodologies. I think what you're doing is an interesting move in that direction. Certainly, you know, with this last experiment we talked about, and it'll be interesting to see if others can build that also in at the macro level as well. So
yes.
In other words, if this can sort of be turned back and fed into the cultivation hypothesis, we might see not a reconfiguration, but a different level of understanding about what we're really studying in cultivation, and whether it's going to be television now or something different in the future. You know, who knows what screens or boxes and things we'll be listening to and watching. It seems likely that the thing least likely to change is that there will be narrative. And whether structures of narrative change much radically over time is an interesting question too. Well, in any case, Michael, we're running up against the clock here. Any other interesting research going on we should know about from you at Iowa State?
Well, I would say we have some extensions of this narrative causality idea. We're seeing how it responds in the face of contradictory belief structures, so not just learning about the environment, but when it directly opposes what you perceive.
Right.
We're looking at the effects of it over time, and then I'm also looking at the interaction between narrative causality and other narrative constructs. So,
yep.
For instance, we did perceived realism.
Right.
And it turns out there's quite an interesting interaction there.
Well, so, that's another major variable for cultivation as well.
Mm-hmm. And I think the tricky part with future cultivation studies and integrating cultivation and narrative is that they are at such different levels. Narrative is at the individual, what does a narrative do to you,
right.
The effects. Cultivation is at the macro, cumulative effects. And the tricky part that I think is very fruitful, but future research has to be very careful, is how to merge those two levels.
Yeah, right. And cultivation has always been seen as a macro level theory. Many folks have looked for the cognitive or psychological mechanism, if you will, and there's been some fruitful stuff there. Certainly the stuff by Shrum along the lines of heuristic processing and so forth. This is another interesting avenue. There's some others. But you're right. I think linking those two levels is a big challenge. So we'll be looking for your stuff in the future. Do you have a website handy if people are interested in your research that they can check out?
Actually, I'm building it right now.
Oh, cool. Well, I'll tell you what. When it's built, you can send me the address, and I'll post that on the website for the podcast.
That would be wonderful.
So you will get literally dozens of hits from from your appearance on the podcast here today.
Wonderful. Thank you.
No problem. Michael, thanks so much for being on. I hope we can have you on again soon when you've got new findings. And best of luck with this interesting research.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to speak with you.
Thanks. Okay, so for listeners interested in the Communication Research Podcast and the Communication Research Center here at Boston University, please visit our website at www.bu.edu/com. And there are links both to the podcast and to the other activities of the center, including publications by the various members. The podcast is on iTunes. Just plug the term communication research into the podcast search box, and you will find us there. So until next time, thanks. This is Jim Shanahan for the Communication Research Podcast. Bye-bye.